period November to February is the flu season, and the time when viruses really make their mark. Doctors' waiting rooms are full of people with coughs and snuffly noses, and our hospitals come under added pressure as people are admitted with complications of flu. As a GP, I often come across patients who think they have flu. If anyone can really explain the difference between a cold and flu, it's John Oxford, Professor of Virology at Queen Mary and Westfield College, and a world expert in flu. I went to go and visit him at his lab in East London.
Well, this is my lab. This is what's called a semi-containment laboratory. There's reduced pressure here. We've got the music to keep everyone happy. There's slightly reduced pressure, so to get it, you can't just walk into this laboratory. You have to have a secure system, a little card system to get in. And then when you get in, for example, so push open the door. You can't step too far in. But you can get in up to where this is written on the floor. But you can hear those cabinets over there, well, a negative pressure cabinet, slightly negative pressure, with a HEPA filter in the top of them. So no virus, the air's been sucked into them, no virus can kind of blow out. So all the viruses are dealt with in those cabinets. That's what the noise is in the background. And then you can do some things on the bench. And these great massive refrigerators are where we keep the virus at minus 70 degrees.
And what research is going on currently in this lab?
This will be influenza, respiratory syncytial and common cold viruses. And we work with respiratory syncytial. We're doing clinical work here because we've got a quarantine here on the other side of this building. We have a 24-bed quarantine unit. We'll get volunteers in and deliberately infect them.
Back in what I think is the relative safety of his office, I asked Professor Oxford, when is a cold just a cold? And when can you say it's flu?
It's the $100,000 question, I think. You know, what's the difference between a bad cold and a mild flu? And it's not easy to distinguish, is it? You wouldn't really expect someone with a common cold to be wanting to go to bed or have aches and pains all over the body and headache and feels that people have battered them around. So those are kind of the two extremes. But the mild flu and the rampant cold can merge and be very difficult to sort out.
What viruses are currently circulating?
As far as I know, I would guess that and predict that the viruses on the move are those viruses which are in the vaccine strain. And this year, there's what's called an H1N1 related to the swine flu pandemic, H1N1 in the vaccine strain. There's a virus called H3N2, both influenza A viruses, and there's an influenza B.
Does that mean we won't be seeing swine flu this year as a problem?
I don't think we will in England be seeing swine flu. I think it's had its little day. And it's, you know, these pandemic strains, they come in waves. The first wave, like 2009, it's not necessarily the biggest wave in the first wave. And I think the wave last year was bigger than the first wave. And it's probably soaked up most of the susceptibles in the community. The viruses, they're Darwinian. These flu viruses, is survival of the fittest. It's occupying an ecological niche and defending it from other viruses. And for the last two or three years, that niche has been occupied by the swine influenza A virus. It has been so powerful, Darwinian in its Darwinian nature, that it's pushed out other influenza A viruses, like the H3N2, that would normally cause problems in the elderly group, because swine virus, H1N1, can't cause problems in the elderly group because they've seen it all before. In the 40s and 50s. So from anyone over the age of 65, it's been a happy 2 years because they've not been able to be infected with the swine virus. The H3N2, which could cause problems with them, has been forced out by that virus. So they've coasted along quite happily. But I don't think the situation is going to be the same this year, unfortunately. And that's why particularly people in the risk group should go out and get some vaccine like today.
Who should have the flu vaccine?
It's the older group, it's the extremes of age, and it's the under fours. The under fours getting, as we saw last year, I mean, children dying are 1, 2, 3, and 4-year-olds. So, you know, you have to be careful about those groups. And then in the intermediate ages are even more difficult to persuade to come and get vaccine. Those are people with chronic bronchitis, people who are obese, as we now recognise quite clearly, diabetics, and people with any more or less chronic disease going on, kidney, whatever, are kind of vulnerable. And they should be vaccinated.
It's interesting you say obese people because they're certainly not part of the vaccination programme for us, unless they have another illness such as diabetes.
Yes, this obesity thing came up clearly in the 2009 pandemic. You know, the first 100 people to die in the United States of the swine flu, the newly emerging swine flu, it was people who had pre-existing problems, the things we just mentioned, plus people who were obese. And I think a third of the deaths were caused by obesity without diabetes. Not only that, but it is becoming clear that obese people don't respond all that well to the vaccine either. So you've got a double kind of whammy, if you like. When they get infected, they get into problems more easily. You try and protect with immunisation, then their immune response is less than that of a person of the normal weight of their age group. So it's a bit of a problem.
But if you have the vaccine, can you still get flu?
The vaccine has been extremely good with the swine flu. It's been extremely good. The figures of protection with that vaccine have been like 80, 90%. I mean, they're not normally as good as that because you can never get the perfect match. You just can't. We're not superhumans. We're not God. We do our best, but the match is not perfect. So normally, the most recent trials that have been done, two big trials recently, the protective effect is about 75%. But that's not bad. I mean, it's not 100%, but 75%, and then you'll get amelioration as well. So you're exchanging a few minutes of discomfort, just a few minutes, for a 75% protection against something that could kill you. It's not a bad bargain.
And also health workers. Would you recommend that all health workers are immunised?
I would recommend that health workers are. It's been a terrible soul-destroying business, persuading doctors and nurses to go and get vaccinated. It really has, in the hospital, everywhere. You know, the vaccination rates in healthcare workers are disastrously low in England. I don't understand why. The only explanation I have is that that healthcare workers are usually quite young, and they usually, in their mind, have a vaccination clinic. I know my GP is a wonderful clinic, but it's full of people over the age of 65, you see. And the young nurse and doctor look and say, well, you know, flu, oh, yeah, I know, I remember the clinic, it's all to do with 65. I'm not 65, I'm 38, why should I have it? So there's a touch of that about it, age-relatedness about it. Not many, to be frank, it is correct that not many of the other risk groups, the younger ones, are being vaccinated. It's concentrated almost entirely on the over 65s. And I think that's a factor. Other countries have broken through. And the United States, for example, last year, nearly 80% of their healthcare workers were vaccinated. And it is very important because, after all, no one working in the healthcare area wants to be responsible for carrying a virus into their patients and killing them in the intensive care unit. And no one wants to carry a virus home and cause serious problems to their grandparents or their children. So a vaccination thing could prevent both the carriage and themselves getting ill anyway.
What's the advice currently about preventing you catching flu from somebody else? I say that because we were told to put our hands in front of our mouth when we coughed, and I believe that's changed.
Yes, that's very much changed. I mean, I wish I could say that there's a huge advertising campaign from the Department of Health like there was 3 years ago, but there isn't. I mean, this is the whole what, save money but have half the population infected, you know. Basically, there's a new etiquette with these respiratory viruses about coughing and sneezing. And the new etiquette comes from the Center of Disease Control in Atlanta. You know, that's the epicenter of scientific knowledge in one sense. And the etiquette is you no longer cough into your hands because, after all, what are you going to do with your hands? You know, because the virus from your mouth and throat will now be stuck on your hands. And immediately you touch something or shake hands with people, the virus will then move on. So what do? So the etiquette is you cough and sneeze into your elbow. Not the pointed end, but the kind of folded end. So that's where you do your cough. And no one ever grasps you by the elbow when they meet you. So there's the reduced chance of the virus moving to someone else.
If you were the chief medical officer, what would be your priorities?
My priority then would be, at this time of the year, would be to get the vulnerable groups in the community vaccinated. I would have a little publicity campaign, I really would. And about hygiene as well. It's a world, still a world, of microbes. They outnumber us on this planet. It has not gone away. There's only ever been two microbes eradicated from this planet. That's smallpox and rinderpest, the virus of cattle. We may eradicate polio, but it's proving difficult to force over the edge. They do not go into that dark night lightly. They do not.
Until such time as this season's flu viruses head off into that dark night, those at risk should be vaccinated. Directly after this interview, this healthcare professional went off to have a flu jab.